Hello and welcome to the Illinois Radio Reader. I'm Janelle Eckerman and today I'll be reading selections from the Decatur Herald and Review for Monday, February 16, 2026. And from the front page, the first article is Central Illinois, Penny Shortage Pinches Stores, and the article is written by Erica Tulfo. Retailers bear consumers' frustrations, advocates say. Springfield. At the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum in Springfield, visitors can shop for sweatshirts, pillows, jewelry, and chocolates using coins bearing the face of perhaps the most famous Illinoisan, Abraham Lincoln. But even here, pennies are growing scarce at the cash register. The museum gift shop, like the rest of the country, is grappling with a penny shortage after the United States Mint halted production of the coin in November, citing the rising cost of producing them. The lack of fixed guidance from the state and federal governments about how to cope with the shortage of new pennies has left some business owners scrambling to come up with ways to address it. Many retailers are just rounding up or down to the nearest 0 or 5 cent mark in their prices to make change. They will accept the 1 cent coins, but can't always pay them out. The retailer faces frustration on behalf of the consumer, said Rob Carr, president of the Illinois Retail Merchants Association. Most retailers are rounding in the consumer's favor, which doesn't make the consumer mad, but it also takes profits out of the retailer and puts them at the narrowest end of the net profit margin. So every penny matters there. I think the absence of clear guidance at the moment is difficult. Some businesses, like the Lincoln Museum gift shop, display a guide on how its rounding system works, and this article is then continued onto page A2. The museum, for example, rounds amounts ending in 1 or 2 cents down to zero. It rounds amounts ending in 3 or 4 cents up to 5 cents, and amounts ending in 6 or 7 cents down to 5 cents. However, other business owners say this kind of multi-tiered rounding system can be inconvenient and confusing for customers. For many Illinoisans, there is a sad end of an era feeling watching the slow disappearance of the 1 cent coin, which was one of the first coins made by the U.S. Mint after its establishment in 1792. President Lincoln's profile has been on the headside since 1909, and that change made him the first president featured on U.S. coins in honor of his 100th birthday. Mary Disler has been working as a volunteer at the Lincoln Museum for over 20 years since its founding in 2005. As a diehard fan of Lincoln, she sees the decision to stop penny production as a sad but sensible decision. "It kind of breaks my heart. I think it's a nice tribute to Mr. Lincoln, but I understand that it's costing 4 cents to make a penny, so there's a part of us that has to be practical too," she said. Keith Weatherall, executive director of the Illinois Beverage Association, which represents a handful of small, cash-reliant or cash-exclusive businesses, has practical concerns too. He worries that the inconvenience posed by complicated rules around rounding could affect customers' sentiments. "The one thing that we would really lobby against was any type of bouncing around from city to city where you have all these different rules and stuff. We want to just minimize the confusion," he said. "We just like to make everything as good and as easy as possible for the customer." Small businesses are struggling as it is. "We don't want any operational challenges. When customers have challenges, they take it out on us by not buying them as much." Julie Johnson, who owns Daisy Jane's, a boutique in downtown Springfield, said she rounded up cash change to the benefit of the customer when necessary, but would rather use pennies to give them exact amounts. "My jar is pretty low on coins. I'm going to have to figure out what the state wants us to do with pennies," she said. "There has to be a plan for that. When you calculate tax on something, it's almost always going to have pennies as part of the equation." How will lawmakers respond? Illinois lawmakers say the penny shortage is not an issue at the top of the agenda because of factors like the popularity of cashless payment methods and the fact that there are still billions of pennies in circulation. Senator Dave Svyson, Cherry Valley, wrote a note on his website in November applauding the US Treasury's decision to halt production, saying it was more of an inconvenience than a useful part of the economy. He said no steps were currently being taken to address the shortage at the state level and that he would await guidance from the federal level. It'll be something that'll obviously start working on addressing more and more as the pennies become less in circulation. It doesn't look like people have to worry about it at all for 2026. I'm guessing that the soonest there'd be any guidance would be 27, when they would maybe set some rules about requiring businesses to accept whatever rounding decision that gets made. Bakar, head of the Retail Merchants Association, said he wasn't satisfied with Springfield playing the waiting game and leaving the decision up to the US Treasury. While the federal government makes currency decisions, the states make sales tax decisions, so it's a shared responsibility, he said. While there's clarity that the federal government needs to provide, there's also clarity that the state needs to provide. That clarity, it helps in terms of lawsuits as well, because there are lawyers out there who can sue if they don't think you've done something correctly. And without that guidance, it leaves the retailers certainly exposed. Gordon Davis, founder of the Springfield tea store Whimsy Tea, said he hasn't had issues with a penny shortage yet, but that it was looming. He said that while 72% of his customers opted to pay with cards, more than one quarter still chose to pay with cash. Instead of rounding prices, Davis made prices tax-inclusive in his store's point-of-sale system, which he says saves him the trouble of facing legal complications with rounding. Rounding, as I understand, can run you afoul of federal law because you have to treat all currencies, all payment methods, the same. If you're rounding for cash but not rounding for card, you're breaking the law, he said. Still, experts say that beyond minor adjustment costs on the retailer's end, the penny shortage won't pose a major issue in terms of price increases simply because its value is low. Inflation-wise, it's not creating a problem, said Xian Xie, an assistant professor of monetary economics at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. The value of the penny has diminished. It's a point where the value is so small that it's not going to affect daily life much or that it becomes crazy. But for some citizens of the land of Lincoln, the penny shortage is an issue that has more to do with sentiment. Lincoln Museum volunteer Dezella said she understands the economics no longer support the beloved 1 cent piece. We'll still have the $5 bill, she said. Even though they're phasing the penny out, we'll keep his memory alive forever. And with this article, there are three photos, and the main photo is from the front page, and the caption reads, US Treasurer Brandon Beach holds the last penny stamped at the US Mint on November 12 in Philadelphia. Beach pressed the final pennies at an event held at the facility, and that photo was courtesy of Matthew Hatcher from Getty Images. And the next two photos are from page A2, and the first caption is, the gift shop at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Museum has a printed guide for customers explaining how its penny rounding system works. And the second photo is of Springfield native Mary DeSella, who is a lifetime volunteer at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Museum, where she educates visitors about the legacy of America's 16th president. And those photos were courtesy of Erica Tulfo Photos from the Medell, Illinois News Bureau. And my apologies for any mispronunciations. I'll now move on to page A3 in state or nation news. And the first article is States Eyeing Cost of Living. And the article is written by Jeff Mulville. State officials are attempting to address voters' worries about the rising cost of living, including housing and everyday items such as groceries, utilities, and childcare. As governors give their annual State of the State speeches, many are designing their messages to speak to constituents' concerns about affordability. Because the issue is so broad, there are a lot of things governors can try. But for the same reason, there's no one policy that's likely to bridge the gap between stagnated wages and expenses that are growing for many people. Maine's Democratic Governor Janet Mills wants to send $300 relief checks to 725,000 residents. Others are imposing caps on utility hikes or calling for easier ways to build more housing. About half of US adults, 54%, said the cost of groceries was a major source of stress in their lives, according to an AP NORC poll from October. At least 4 in 10 said the cost of housing, their savings, their pay and the cost of healthcare were major sources of stress. AP NORC polling from December found about 9 in 10 US adults said they had experienced higher prices for groceries in recent months, and about 7 in 10 said that about electricity. The government's main measure of inflation shows that average annual prices rose by less than 3% from 2012 until 2021, when prices rose sharply. Since the middle of 2023, annual increases have been hovering around 3%, but price tags are higher than they were before the surge, and some costs, including electricity and housing, have risen faster than the average. Republicans have long prioritized tax cuts as a way to give some people relief. Officials in states including Florida, Georgia and North Dakota are aiming to eliminate property taxes for homeowners over time. Kentucky and Mississippi are on long-term paths to get rid of income taxes. Critics of those approaches warn that such moves could increase states' reliance on sales taxes, which disproportionately affect low-income people. When President Donald Trump was seeking a return to the White House in 2024, he promised to make America affordable again and has recently returned to the theme. But he's been critical of the way his political opponents talk about affordability, repeatedly calling it a hoax or scam by Democrats, whom he blames for higher prices. California Governor Gavin Newsom, Massachusetts Governor Maura Healey and Arizona Governor Katie Hobbs, all Democrats, have called for multi-prong approaches to affordability with a focus on housing. In her State of the Commonwealth speech last month, Healey called for converting empty offices into apartments and using government-owned property to build housing. Hobbs proposed charging a nightly fee on vacation rentals and using the money it generates to help families with housing and utility costs. Newsom told lawmakers that they should pass a law to stop institutional investors from buying houses in bulk. Francis Torres, Director of Housing and Infrastructure Projects at the Bipartisan Policy Center, said some of the most sweeping actions don't immediately lead to new housing. There's a difference between legalizing housing on paper and the housing actually being built, he said. And that's a reason that officials are also trying to offer support with down payments and other methods intended to help in the meantime. In New Jersey, utility rates were a big part of the conversation in last year's governor race. When Democrat Mikey Sherrill was sworn in January, she immediately signed two executive orders, one to freeze utility rates and another aimed at establishing more electricity production, including solar and nuclear power. And the next article from the same page is protesters rally at ICE holding facility. Organisers look to hold recurring protests every week on Saturdays. And the article is written by Eva Remajan Toba. Chicago. Around 50 people attended a peaceful rally Saturday outside the Broadview Immigration and Customs Enforcement Processing Center, which became a focal point for protests last fall during Operation Midway Blitz, a 64-day surge of immigration enforcement raids throughout Chicago and surrounding suburbs. It's fitting to be here on Valentine's Day, Little Village community organiser Jasmine said to the crowd. Happy Valentine's Day to everybody except ICE. Jasmine, who chose to be identified only by their first name for fear of being doxxed, was among several speakers who gathered Saturday outside the West Suburban facility to protest recent federal enforcement actions. Even though fear is at times more present than joy, there is unity across national lines, Jasmine said. We are fighting alongside our immigrant working class siblings from around the world. Saturday's demonstration came during a nationwide effort by young people to protest ICE. On Friday afternoon, hundreds of students walked out of their schools and gathered in downtown's Federal Plaza to advocate for immigrant communities. Ian, who also chose to go by his first name, is part of an autonomous group that organises regular protests against ICE. He has attended demonstrations in Broadview since September and served as the rally's MC. I am tired of having to decide between spending time with my children or fighting to make sure this country is still a safe place for them to grow up, Ian said to the crowd. Ian and other organisers said they plan to hold recurring protests outside the Broadview facility every Saturday at noon. I can't sleep because when I close my eyes, I see the six-year-old girl I watched at the former Lexington Street care tent while her mum attempted to deliver diabetes medication to her father at the facility, Ian said. I see Silverio Villegas Gonzalez. I see Keith Porter Jr. I see Renee Nicole Good, and I see Alex Pretty. All four among those who have died at the hands of ICE. Between speakers, the Songs for Liberation Protest Music Collective performed Abolish ICE. Those familiar with the song sang along, and others joined in as they learned the lyrics. This is for our people who are locked inside. Together we will abolish ICE, the crowd sang. This is for our workers who are forced to hide. Together we will abolish ICE. The US is funding these atrocities. That's why we ain't gonna stop till Broadview is free. As the crowd sang, protesters held signs aloft. Among them was Ryan Hatfield, 40, and his wife, who carried a heart-shaped Valentine's candy-style sign reading expletive ICE. The couple said they chose to spend Valentine's Day in Broadview out of frustration with what Hatfield described as a federal crackdown on people who made this country great. I want to see ICE out of Chicago, out of our cities, Hatfield said. I want to see them doing what they initially said they were going to do, which is cracking down on people that are, you know, the worst criminals. Not people dropping their kids off in daycare, not people working jobs, trying to provide for their families and not committing crimes. Earlier this week, Cook County prosecutors dropped charges against 19 people arrested during a clergy-led protest at the Broadview facility last November. Faith leaders had sought to provide religious counselling to detainees but were denied entry. Clashes with local law enforcement followed and 21 people were arrested. Most cases have been dismissed, though two people still face charges. Isaac Palmer, 24, one of the first protesters to arrive Saturday, carried a megaphone and wore a Captain America shield with a matching shirt. First they came to our area, Palmer said, referencing federal agents. They were picking up a lot of people simply based on the colour of their skin. Though he appeared to be the only superhero-themed protester at Saturday's rally, Palmer said he had seen others dressed as comic book characters at past demonstrations. This isn't like the comic books where the villains are pretend, Palmer said. We're fighting real injustice. And the photo with this article is captioned: portraits of people killed by federal immigration agents are posted on a fence near the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Facility at 1930 Beach Street as people attend a protest of federal immigration agencies, February 14, 2026, in Broadview. And that photo was courtesy of John J. Kim from the Chicago Tribune. I'll now move on to page A4 in today's reading of the Decatur Herald and Review for Monday, February 16. and I'll include the weather report, the Decatur 4-day forecast. And today it'll be partly sunny, and the wind will be from the south-southwest at 8 to 16 miles per hour, and the temperature 64 degrees. And tonight it'll be partly cloudy, and the wind will be from the south at 7 to 14 miles per hour, and the temperature 40 degrees. And on Tuesday, it'll be breezy in the PM. Wind will be from the south-southeast at 10 to 20 miles per hour. There'll be a high of 60 degrees with a low of 54 degrees. And on Wednesday, a strong AM thunderstorm. The wind will be from the west-southwest at 10 to 20 miles per hour. There'll be a high of 69 degrees with a low of 41 degrees. And on Thursday, there'll be an afternoon thunderstorm, and the wind will be from the south at 10 to 20 miles per hour. There'll be a high of 69 degrees with a low of 34 degrees. And in the regional outlook, it'll be partly sunny today with a temperature near the record of 65. Expect 4 to 8 hours of sunshine with average relative humidity 65% and fair drying conditions. Partly cloudy tonight, and there'll be an average humidity of 75%. Sunrise today will be at 6:47 a.m. and sunset 5:33 p.m. And moonrise 6:30 a.m. and moonset 4:52 p.m. The new moon will be February 17, the first quarter February 24, the full moon March 3, and the last quarter March 11. And from the same page, the next article is Storm System Sweeps Across Southeast US. And that information is from the Associated Press, Atlanta. A storm system sweeping across the southeast late Saturday and Sunday brought tornado warnings to Mississippi and Louisiana, and then took aim at parts of Georgia and Florida as people in the northeast were finally getting a reprieve from weeks of bitterly cold temperatures. Some of the fiercest storms in the south were reported near Lake Charles, Louisiana, where high winds from a thunderstorm overturned a horse trailer and a Mardi Gras float, damaged an airport jet bridge, and flung the metal awning from a house into power lines. The damage was documented by National Weather Service employees who surveyed the area. Power poles were snapped and toppled near the Louisiana towns of Jenna, Cheneyville, and Donaldsonville. The Weather Service reported no deaths or serious injuries were reported, but the damage reports came as the storm system continued its path into parts of South Georgia and the Florida Panhandle, which were under tornado watches Sunday. This weekend storms led to some power outages across the south, but nowhere near the massive number of outages caused by ice storms late last month in northern Mississippi and Nashville, Tennessee. Early Sunday afternoon, more than 12,000 customers were without power in northern Florida, according to PowerOutage.us, which tracks outages nationwide. About 7,000 customers were without power in Mississippi and another 6,000 in Louisiana. Meanwhile, the northeast was beginning to thaw after a weeks-long stretch of bitterly cold weather. Boston was running nearly 7 degrees Fahrenheit below average for February by midweek, and the city was on pace for its coldest winter in more than a decade. Boston remained cold on Sunday, but the week's forecast called for temperatures climbing into the high 30s and low 40s, which is closer to the seasonal average. On the west coast, much of California braced for a powerful winter storm that was expected to bring drenching thunderstorms, damaging winds and heavy snow in mountain areas. Jacob Spender, a Weather Service meteorologist in Sacramento, urged people to take precautions in the coming days. So if they are traveling, packing winter safety kits, anything to be prepared. This is a bigger system and a major system, Spender said. I'll return to page A3, and the next article is When the Doctor Needs a Checkup. Hospitals use cognition tests on aging workforce. And it's written by Paula Spann. He was a surgical oncologist at a hospital in a southern city a 78-year-old whose colleagues had begun noticing troubling behaviour in the operating room. During procedures, he seemed hesitant, not sure of how to go on to the next step without being prompted, said Mark Catlick, director of the Aging Surgeon Program at Sinai Hospital in Baltimore. The chief of surgery, concerned about the doctor's cognition, would not sign off on his credentials to practice surgery unless he went through an evaluation, Catlick said. Since 2015, when Sinai inaugurated a screening program for surgeons 75 and older, about 30 from around the country have undergone its two-day physical and cognitive assessment. This surgeon did not come out of his own accord, Catlick recalled, but he came. The tests revealed mild cognitive impairment, often but not necessarily a precursor to dementia. The neuropsychologist report advised that the surgeon's difficulties were likely to impact his ability to practice medicine as he is doing presently, e.g. conducting complex surgical procedures. That didn't mean the surgeon had to retire. A variety of accommodations would allow him to continue in other roles. He retained a lifetime of knowledge that had not been impacted by cognitive changes, Catlick said. The hospital took him out of the OR, but he continued to see patients in the clinic. Such incidents are likely to become more common as America's physician workforce ages rapidly. In 2005, more than 11% of doctors who were seeing patients were 65 or older, the American Medical Association said. Last year, the proportion reached 22.4%. Given physician shortages, nobody wants to drive out veteran doctors with skills and experience. Yet researchers have documented a gradual decline in physicians' cognitive abilities starting in their mid-60s, said Thomas Gallagher, an internist and bioethicist at the University of Washington. At older ages, reaction times slow. Knowledge can become outdated. Cognitive scores vary greatly, however. A few health organisations have responded by establishing programs mandating that older doctors be screened for cognitive and physical deficits. UVA Health at the University of Virginia began its program in 2011 and has screened about 200 older practitioners. Only in 4 cases did the results significantly change a doctor's practice or privileges. Stanford Healthcare launched its late career program the following year. Penn Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania also put in place a testing program. Nobody has tracked how many programs exist. Gallagher guesstimated as many as 200. Late career programs typically require those 70 and older to be evaluated before their privileges and credentials are renewed, with confirmatory testing for those whose initial results indicate problems. Thereafter, older doctors undergo regular rescreening. It's fair to say such efforts proved unpopular among their intended targets. Doctors frequently insist that, "I'll know when it's time to stand down," said Rocco Orlando, senior strategic advisor to Hartford Healthcare, which operates 8 Connecticut hospitals and began its late career practitioner program in 2018. It turns out not to be true. When Hartford Healthcare published data from the first 2 years of its late career program, it reported that of the 160 practitioners, 70 and older, who were screened, 14.4% showed some degree of cognitive impairment. That mirrored results from Yale New Haven Hospital, which instituted mandatory cognitive screening for medical staff members starting at age 70. Among the first 141 Yale clinicians who underwent testing, 12.7% demonstrated cognitive deficits, a study reported. I'll now take a short break and return with part two of today's reading of selections from the Decatur Herald and Review for Monday, February 16, 2026, read by Janelle Eckerman. Please stay tuned.